Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500. Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
Today's cool fact of the day is that in a study of rats whose genes were mutated so that they lacked sweet taste receptors, the rats still heavily preferred drinking sugar water to plain water. And that's definitely not just due to taste, because the same results didn't occur when they put sucralose in the water, which is also sweet. So the researchers think that the rats experience dopamine spikes in their brains only after having the real sugar water. That means that the calories may be psychologically, rather than just sensory, delicious. In other words, you kind of feel like you want those calories.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of 6 different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
If you were at the Bulletproof Conference this year, I gave a whole talk about how low levels of ketones can affect the brain and affect your hunger hormone levels. And that's totally relevant, because today's guest is all about cravings. His new book is called Always Hungry: Conquer Cravings, Retrain Your Fat Cells, and Lose Weight Permanently. And that's coming out in January of 2016. His name is David Ludwig. He's a MD, a PhD, a practicing pediatrician and researcher at Boston's Children's Hospital. He's also a professor of pediatrics at the Harvard Medical School and professor of nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health. Technically, I think this makes him a total nutrition badass. Is that actually the case, Dr. Ludwig?
Well, I'll defer to you as the expert on badassness, but thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Thanks for coming on the show. I'm really excited, because it's not so common to get people who are practicing and researching and looking at nutrition and full medical work. So it's a really cool combination of things that you've got going on. And
it's a really great gig. I like my day job.
How did you get into that strange mix of things? It's a very useful mix, but it's unusual. How did you get there?
You know, I've always been very sensitive and aware of food. Okay. Although I was raised, in the 60s and 70s as a kid, when fortunately diets weren't as bad as they are today for kids. But, after school, the ice cream truck would come along, and, we were already getting candies and sweets that had long lists of artificial ingredients. And I ate them like everybody else, but I just always sensed that, you know, I never really felt good about that. And I also come from a very politically active family. My parents were, some of my earliest recollections were being taken to civil rights demonstrations and anti-war protests. So I also, you know, became, you know, very politically aware. I got interested in science and medicine, and all of these interests converged after I finished my training as an endocrinologist, because, you know, it turns out that food has fundamental relevance to our biology, of course. It's also a highly political issue. Every time we eat, we are making a powerful political statement to the food industry as to, you know, what we want and what we don't want. And so I've really found that my day job can include both clinical medicine, seeing patients, relevant to nutrition and health, research, politics, and public health why am I having trouble with that word? Advocacy. And, you know, an advocate has to actually be able to pronounce the word. And so it's really, I feel like that's sort of in my genes.
It's in your genes, and you selected medicine. So you did medicine first, then nutrition, or you did them at the same time?
I started, initially I was thinking I was going to be a straight scientist. Then I got interested in medicine, went to medical school. And at the same time, being a glutton for punishment, got a doctorate as well. And then got interested in endocrinology. But endocrinology is a field which doesn't incorporate any of the standard assumptions of nutrition. You know, I wasn't taught as an endocrinologist to think of food as a delivery system of calories and nutrients. And I became interested in how food affects our hormones, which are powerful. Every time we eat, hormones, not just insulin, but dozens of other hormones and related substances change in profoundly different ways. And these hormones, in turn, alter our metabolism and literally the expression of our genes. So the notion of food as medicine is quite literally true, because virtually every pathway that exists in the body that can be exploited for drugs were there originally in a direct or indirect fashion to integrate food with our physiology.
Wow. So that really does blur the line between food and drugs, doesn't it?
Well, we can use food as a drug for better and for worse.
Yeah.
You know, we did a study relating to the study you announced at the beginning of the hour. We looked at, this was a double-blind study, which is difficult to do in nutrition because typically people and the researchers see what's being eaten. But in this case, we made two milkshakes that had the same calories, the same protein, fat, and carbohydrate. In one case, it was fast-acting carbohydrate, and the other case, slow-digesting carbohydrate. So we gave these milkshakes in random order to our participants on separate days, followed their blood sugar, and as expected, saw that they had higher blood sugar initially after the fast-acting carbohydrate shake. Blood sugar tended to crash a few hours later. At that point, the participants reported feeling hungrier. And then we did brain scans, and the results were really remarkable. I'm not a neuroscientist. It turned out that one area, and I didn't know what this area was at first, lit up like a laser in every single subject. So it lit up after the fast acting or high glycemic index shake, but not after the low. In fact, it was so consistent that we had astronomically strong statistical power. And that area was the nucleus accumbens. You know, so for the rest of your audience who, like me, aren't neuroscientists, that's the center of the dopaminergic reward pleasure center of the brain.
Wow.
It's considered ground zero for the classic addictions of cocaine, heroin, alcoholism, and the like, raising a provocative idea that, certainly we need food to live. So food addiction is very controversial. But raising the possibility that these highly processed, very rapidly digesting industrial foods we're eating today can hijack fundamental pleasure and reward systems of the brain. Now, it's one thing to feel hungry because your blood sugar is dropping, but it's a different thing if your nucleus accumbens kicks in, because then your ability to resist that 500 calorie bear claw you see in the pastry shop is going to vanish. So hunger and cravings are a really difficult combination to fight. And I think that the food industry would like to say it's all our personal responsibility to just control our calorie balance, that there are no bad foods. But I think there's quite a strong line of investigation to suggest that certain foods profoundly undermine our metabolism in ways that are not all that different to certain classic drugs of addiction.
There's my favorite fast food, processed food marketing slogan ever: you can't eat just one. you fire up that part of the brain and literally you're going to have that drug-like response, like, I've got to eat the whole bag of potato chips, not just one. And so you found in your study exactly which part of the brain is contributing to that, even in the absence of the blood sugar crash, right? Because you're talking about a brain craving that's dopamine-based. It's a neurotransmitter, not just a glucose thing.
Right. Okay. Now, that may be responding to the fact that blood sugar, and it's not just sugar, but it's also fatty acids and ketones, the total source, and this is really the focus of the book I've written, it's the total concentration of calories in the blood, which are critically important.
Yeah.
And when they drop, the brain does something which makes perfect sense from an evolutionary perspective. I mean, the brain is critically dependent upon calories. A brief interruption would lead to loss of consciousness, coma, seizure, and death.
Yeah, tigers eat you the second you pass out in nature, like you're dead.
Well, either they'll eat you or your brain cells will die, and either way, it won't matter to you. So the brain has very powerful mechanisms to get us to make sure that the brain has enough calories. The first thing it does is make us hungry. The second thing is it starts activating craving centers. So our ability to say no vanishes. And then after that, stress hormones start to be secreted, emergency stress hormones that drag calories out of storage sites, but do so, and that will temporarily solve the problem, but it does so causing great stress to the body. And finally, with these swings in calorie levels and hormones, if that continues, metabolism will actually slow down. So we did a study of 21 young adults who had high body mass index, brought their weight down by 10 or 15%, which we know is a stress. They're going to feel hungry. Their metabolism is going to be slowing down. It's the body's defense mechanisms. And then we put them for a month at a time on one of three diets in a randomized fashion. So on one side of the equation was a low-fat diet, kind of what we've been recommending. Government's been recommending, I should say, for years, 20% fat, 60% carbs. The other side was a classic Atkins diet with a whopping 60% fat content. And in the middle was, we called it a low glycemic index, sort of a Mediterranean diet with 40% fat, 40% carb. And so we found that so we gave them the same calories and they had the same weight. It was locked in. Energy expenditure plummeted on the low fat diet. And that was expected. On the low carb diet, energy expenditure, metabolic rate didn't drop at all. It was completely, despite the weight loss, that low carb diet had completely abolished the negative effects of weight loss. Yeah. And the Mediterranean diet was in the middle. And that difference was 325 calories a day. That's like an hour of moderately vigorous physical activity without lifting a finger. So I think both of these studies are providing support to the notion that all calories aren't alike metabolically, and that if you simply focus on calorie restriction with the wrong foods, you're going to be setting up a battle between mind and metabolism that you're likely doomed to lose.
Amen, brother. Oh, sorry. That's what happened to me when I weighed 300 pounds. And it's not a willpower thing. It's not a laziness thing for fat people at all. And it's why I'm such a fan of your book and supporting you getting this message out, because you've studied this a lot more than I have, to be honest, and come to more of an academic research-based conclusion versus mine, which is like, okay, I'm going to hack this because I'm tired of being fat and tired. And what you said there, though, is different types of calories do different things, right? What about, say, different types of protein? And do you get into that at all? Where saying, okay, like I had tofu versus eggs, does it matter that much?
Well, let me first come back to the big picture, okay, and then go to that. So the main premise of my book is simple. Overeating doesn't make you fat. The process of getting fat makes you overeat.
I love that. That is so good. Say that one more time so people will hear that.
So overeating doesn't make you fat, at least over the long term. The process of getting fat makes you overeat. Now, that sounds provocative, but there's actually dozens, if not a century, of research involving literally thousands of articles that support this argument, that body weight is controlled more by our biology than our willpower. Yes. So let's walk through this for a moment. We know that when you cut back on calories, let's say you're doing a nutrition study with human participants, you put them on starvation rations for a few weeks, they're going to lose weight. Of course, that's the law of physics.
Famines do that, right?
That's the law of physics. Nothing about this violates physics. But what's going to happen? What's going to happen then? They're going to get very hungry, and their energy expenditure, the calories they burn off, are going to plummet as the body fights back increasingly aggressively against the calorie restriction. Once the people end the study, their weight comes right back up to where it started, typically even a little higher. But the opposite is also true. There's been dozens of overfeeding studies where participants are brought into a research unit, locked down, and then basically force-fed very high-calorie diets. And again, of course, they gain weight. That's physics. But what also happens? They lose all interest in food. They feel very uncomfortable, and their metabolism speeds up in an attempt to shed these extra calories. The participants are as unhappy in overfeeding studies, they're as miserable in overfeeding studies as they are in underfeeding studies, because the body has a certain weight it wants to be and defend. Now, that's like a body weight set point.
Yeah, there's a ghrelin level that drives that, right? Like one of the craving hunger hormones?
Well, there's probably many, many hormones. We think of these hormones like ghrelin and leptin as hunger or satiety hormones. They all have metabolic effects too.
True.
The key actions of leptin, some of the downstream actions may be in the body. Leptin results in fat cells disgorging extra calories, and we'll see why that's so critically important. Just cutting back on calories fights basic biological systems that have evolved over hundreds of millions of years to control our body weight. So what we recommend is turning dieting on its head. We suggest you forget calories. Calories are not a very, they're not a very useful notion. I mean, first of all, not even the world's most trained dietitian could guess calorie balance to within 350 a day accurately. And if you were off just by 350 calories between intake and expenditure a day, that would mean the difference between remaining lean or becoming massively obese in about 5 years. And it begs the question, how did human populations manage to maintain stable body weights amidst an abundance of food? We haven't always been living hand to foot. We had plenty of food, in America in the 1960s without weight shooting up. How did we manage to maintain our body weight before the very notion of calories was invented. So forget calories. We argue that the only way to lose weight permanently is to shift metabolism.
Yes.
Is to retrain fat cells to open up. What the problem with the modern American diet is, especially with all the processed carbohydrate, is that it increases insulin levels and chronic inflammation. Those force fat cells into a feeding frenzy. They suck up too many calories, leaving too few for the rest of the body. That's why we get hungry. That's why we get tired. Just cutting calories makes that situation worse. It doesn't address the fundamental problem, which is that the fat cells have been on calorie storage overdrive.
So if someone eats a 100 calorie kale salad for lunch and you know adds 20 calories of low fat dressing on that, there just isn't enough calorie in the blood, which is going to cause their body to be like, I don't have enough energy right now. It's a crisis. And this whole cycle you talked about would happen versus if they threw a bunch of guacamole on top of it, had enough calories, and then would actually not have this metabolic disarray happen.
Well, you know, certainly if you just don't get enough calories, the body is going to fight back.
Right.
But the problem in America isn't that we're not getting enough. We're obviously getting too much, but they're not staying in our bloodstream. So the calories that we eat from highly processed carbohydrates, especially if there's not enough fat and protein, they flood our bloodstream temporarily for an hour or two after the meal. But insulin shoots up to try to push those calories into storage. And by 3 or 4 hours, we're worse off than we started. All those calories have been locked away in storage, importantly, including fat, and there aren't enough in the bloodstream. So even though we think of obesity as a state of excess, I think it's physiologically more akin to a state of starvation. The body is, the brain and the rest of the body is starving because fat cells are hoarding more than their fair share of calories. And the only way to solve that problem, you know, you can't do it by cutting back calories. That makes the fundamental problem worse. The only way to do that is to change what you're eating in order to lower insulin and calm chronic inflammation. When that happens, the fat cells open up, the body floods with calories. The brain says, wow. I mean, in some cases, it's like the brain gets a sense of sufficiency and satiety for the first time in years. And so it then allows metabolism to speed up, and you naturally will eat less, but this way with your body's cooperation rather than with your body kicking and screaming.
Have you ever been fat?
You know, I was lean and athletic through my adolescence and 20s. I went to medical school just a little bit later because I'd taken off some time, traveled a bit. And I started to notice my late 20s, maybe early 30s, that I'd been putting on a pound or two a year. And, you know, so for the first few years, it didn't much matter because I started out pretty lean. I just got an extra larger pant size or two. But then it kept going. Now, by this point, well into my 30s, I'd already gotten interested in obesity research, although I was at that point more focused in the basic laboratory doing genetic studies. And I reached the BMI of 25, you know, and I realized I had a little bit of an identity crisis. You know, I'm an obesity researcher and I'm about to cross the threshold into overweight. And fortunately, just at that time, I came across new theories of carbohydrate, you know, it's including this notion of glycemic index, how carbohydrate digests and affects our hormones. I spent a few months buried in the Countway Library, which is Harvard's medical library. And back then, it wasn't all online. Yeah. You know, you went to this musty, you know, this literally, you know, dusty floor, two floors underground. And I found articles that dated back, in some cases, to the 1800s. And I just absorbed it all. I put together theories that have been out there. Yeah. I put them together in my own way. So I'm not suggesting that this is by any means all my creation. You know, this is building on research that has been around for decades, if not a century. And then I both designed experiment to do in the laboratory, but I also did an N of one experiment on myself. I increased the fat content. I'd always eaten pretty healthy from a standard perspective, but I'd eaten a lot of, you know, a lot of whole grains and, you know, not too much sugar, but it was a pretty high carbohydrate diet. So I greatly increased fat. I cut back on the refined carbs. I increased protein a bit and no attempt at all to lose weight. 3 months later, I dropped 20 pounds and three waist sizes.
And it was, this was without effort, right?
No, it's really remarkable, you know, and I we have testimonials in the book from the, we did a pilot, national pilot of the books program with a couple hundred, over a couple hundred people for 16 weeks. And most of them report the same thing, that before the first pound was shed, the experience, the cravings just seem to vanish. Just like that study, the brain imaging.
Yeah.
It's like a metabolic switch is being flipped. Just cravings turn off. People, in every story in the book is, you know, I'm a scientist and so I'm not creating any, I'm not making any of these stories up, you know, as sometimes is fashionable. Every story is people's actual experience. We have their first name and last initial, age and location. And, you know, you'll see that people describe feeling like their metabolism is shifting.
Yeah.
And then the rest is kind of automatic. The body, it's like you've been in an overfeeding study. Your body finally recognizes that it's got too many calories and it tries to get rid of those extra calories in the way that it knows how. It diminishes your cravings and it speeds up your metabolism. And people find that they can lose weight without the struggle. Now, it might be slightly slower than if you restricted calories. Clearly, if you cut back calories 1,000 a day, you're going to lose weight fast. But then you're going to be struggling for the rest of your life to keep it off.
Yeah.
This may be a little slower, although there were some people who lost 2 to 3 pounds a week at first. Other people lost 0.5 pound a week. But they're eating lush, satisfying, rich foods as much as they want to feel satisfied. Yeah. They're snacking when they're hungry. And so you're reestablishing a collaboration with your body, which for many people, you know, there's been alienation. So the first step is to sort of relink our behavior, our biology, and our diet.
I had learned when I was obese, like to sort of value the feeling of hunger. Like, wow, I'm really hungry. Like that makes me a good person, right? Which actually it doesn't. It makes you hangry and you hypoglybitchy or whatever you want to call it. But you're not nice when you're hungry. But you're like, okay, I'm doing this. Like I'm going to take one for the team. And it's really a self-destructive state. And it's one that's taught because, well, by self-denial, you're supposed to somehow be helping your biology. But it turns out you're not helping your personality. You're not helping your biology. You're not helping your hormones. And you're burning huge amounts of energy on fighting off cravings. And you lose eventually anyway. And then you kind of feel like a failure. So it's interesting. You've got people eating as much as they want and not feeling hunger. And what I came to believe is that, you know, hunger is a powerful, useful signal from your body that you're doing something wrong. And it's that, oh my God, you should eat. And you should eat the right stuff. And when you do that, your hunger should go away for a long period of time. And if the hunger comes back quickly, then you did something wrong because you didn't eat enough. You didn't eat the right stuff. And that hunger is really, really useful, but it's not something to treasure because it's going to make you thinner. That kind of thinness comes at huge cost biologically and like energetically or emotionally.
I completely agree with you. And, we have a kind of a 5-hour rule. If you eat a meal and you are feeling not overstuffed initially, but then not famished several hours later, if your energy remains good, your mental clarity remains good, then you ate the right amount and you ate the right type of food.
Yes.
And if not, it's a learning up. Yeah. It's just an experiment. You're the biohacker. So that's the opportunity to revise. One other thing I wanted to add, you know, I guess, I don't know if this is literally true, but I heard that like the Native Americans have 20 names for corn because that's so important. That was so important to certain Native American societies that were agricultural. And the Inuits in the north had 20 names for snow, all these different subtle gradations. You know, I think we need more words for hunger.
Yes.
You know, hunger isn't this all the same thing. You know, there's a hunger where you're desperately hungry, yeah, you're
craving.
In desperate need for food, you're craving, your energy is crashing, you feel a basic like instability in your core. Mm-hmm. That's because primal brain areas are being threatened by lack of calories in your bloodstream. There's another kind of hunger which you get after eating a really just the right, you get hit that nutrient ratio just right for lunch, and maybe you're especially active in the afternoon, and then dinner rolls along and you feel this stimulating interest in food. It's not making you, it's not bringing you down and making you desperate. It's actually waking you up and creating an appetite for good food. So those are profoundly different states. One is a state of good metabolic functioning, but your brain saying, you know what, now's the time to recharge. And the other saying, you know what, we've got a medical emergency going.
David, I'm so glad you said that, especially with your great background in research, because those are fundamentally different states. I never knew that there was the state, I call it the I could eat state. Like if I do, the most powerful hunger suppressor breakfast I know of is unquestionably bulletproof coffee. And there's a fat signaling thing in there. But if I do that, when lunchtime rolls around, I get this kind of like, you know, I could eat. Like it's 1 p.m. or something. I've gone 5 hours. Like, yeah, but I don't have to. I'm not going to die if I don't eat. I could eat and I'm going to feel good if I eat. And I had never experienced that in my life as a former obese person, because every meal was like, okay, I think I can make it, or maybe I'll just have, you know, 3 peanut M&Ms or whatever it is. I just have to have something. And that's why every office has little bowls of candy around, because people are so like broken, they can't do it. So thank you so much. You're the first person I've heard put it that way. But the difference in state to feel liberated from the I'm going to die if I don't eat state, for me, I don't think I ever experienced that till sometime after the age of 30, where I'm like, wow, like food is not in control anymore, because I'm not constantly thinking about the next meal. And you put cravings right in the title or on the cover of your book. And it's absolutely true. What you're dealing with is craving versus hunger. And maybe there's 5 more words for hunger that we could like architect or come out with. But man, I'm so glad you said that. So thank you.
Thank you.
What about snacking though? Because you said you should be able to go snacking 5 hours, but you can snack. But if you need to snack, does that mean you failed and it's okay? Or what's your take on it?
No. Snacking is totally great.
Okay.
And especially in the beginning of a new diet, a weight change. You know, I'm arguing that calories should never be the focus, but we all have different calorie requirements. The question is, who's in control of the calorie balance? Mm-hmm. Is it our bodies or is it a diet doctor? And I argue it should be our bodies. And so it may take a while to figure out what how much food you need and how you match your food amount to different stages of weight loss. During the active stage of weight loss, your body is burning stored fat. So I just kind of thought of this for the first time. Weight loss, you're on a high fat diet, you know, your body's burning fat, you know, and that rate of weight loss and fat burning will change through different stages of the diet. And so your needs are going to change. In addition, physical activity level is, of course, going to change your needs. And there are other variations on physiology that are probably outside of our control. So the way we know is not to get a calorie app that tells us when to stop and then, you know, abdicate responsibility. It's to tune into our body and its most important metabolic signals. The hunger is top of the list. So if you're hungry, eat well. You know, if you find that, you know, you really think you probably should have lasted longer, that's a good opportunity to reassess the meal, but then absolutely snack.
I agree with you, by the way. Absolutely snack if the last meal made you hungry. And I've gotten my own nutrition dialed in so much that like snacking is very, very unusual. And if I do need a snack, it's because I either ate a suspect food or there was a food quality issue with the last meal. And I find that one of the things that causes a blood sugar crash is if all of a sudden you have some toxin exposure, even paint fumes or something like that, because all of a sudden the liver is demanding glucose that would have been available for the brain. It's like, hey, I got to oxidize some really bad stuff, get this out of here. So I'm like, okay, I'm walking along. I should have had stable energy all afternoon because I ate the right amounts of the right foods. And I didn't consciously think about that. I composed the food right, but I ate the amount that my body wanted. You know, I had extra salad if I wanted extra salad and I didn't feel guilty for it, right? Or extra meat, it doesn't matter. That's what the body wanted. But then sometimes there's a crash and that's when snacking saves you. Because if you don't snack, then you go into that deeper and deeper and deeper hunger. Then you just burn more and more willpower, right? And so that's why you're an advocate of snacking. But would you advocate snacking if you're not hungry?
No, I mean, okay. You never, you know, there's no reason to force yourself to eat. But, you know, people in the first phase of our program, we have a three-phase program. Uh-huh. The first phase is high fat, 50% fat, because we're asking people not to give up all carbohydrate. This is not an Atkins right. diet. I think some people actually do need, you know, people, if you've got severe metabolic problems, you really may benefit most quickly by severely limiting carbohydrate. But most people, I think, don't actually have to go to that extreme.
It's some ketones, right? But not massive ketones. Is that the target?
So we start out at 50% fat. We ask people to give up for just 2 weeks all grains, potatoes, and added sugar, except a small amount of added sugar and real dark chocolate, minimum of 70%.
How could you not like that?
85% better. But so to give that up for people who are used to eating a lot of carbohydrate and can't imagine going a day, let alone, you know, meal without eating those processed carbs, that high fat richness really does the trick. You know, people just, you know, they used to be craving cookies in the afternoon and they find that it just turns off. And sometimes after a week or two, they'll go to a party, they'll pick up a cookie and they'll say, it's okay, but yeah. I'm not sure what I ever saw in this. The brain is changing. So that first phase, 50% fat, 25% carbohydrate, 25% protein, just 2 weeks. And that is a time when a lot of powerful changes are happening in the body. And so we specifically ask people to snack. You should never force it, but the body's been in a state of starvation. Mm-hmm. So we want to take the body out of the starvation mode. And the best way to do that is to make sure that there are plenty of calories.
Yeah.
If anything, we want to err on the side of too many calories. I mean, what weight loss diet says err on the side of overeating? That's what we recommend.
It's beautiful to do that because it sets you free from cravings you've had your whole fat life. Like it's beautiful.
That's right. That's right. And then, so that's just 2 weeks though. And then at phase two, we add back whole kernel grains. So unprocessed grains.
So you're not concerned about gluten or any of the other toxins that come in grains?
Yeah, we have options.
Okay.
We have gluten-free options for everybody, and grains are not required by any means. And at the same time, you know, this is a book for
mainstream
America.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't see America as coming off of grains entirely. And in fact, I'm just coming from a conference with Boyd Eaton, who is the paleo mm-hmm. fellow. And, you know, I mean, we all recognize that with 7 billion humans going up to 10 billion pretty soon, we need grains. We're not all going to be hunter-gatherers. But I think there's a way to incorporate grains in the diet that add to culinary variability, but don't undermine your metabolism for, you know, and I think having gluten-free options is really important.
You have a great point there, and thanks for calling that out. There's by acknowledging the limitations of grains, but then using them intelligently, we can also start creating grains that are more beneficial for people. Do you know what I'm saying? Like if we Absolutely. If we know the good stuff, we can grow more with good stuff. But right now, they're like growing extra high gluten because it's easier or because it tastes better in pastries or something. But we're kind of hybridizing in the wrong direction is what I'm
There's
saying.
So many. I mean, they're really, we think of grains as the modern, highly processed wheat, you know, which is bad in every possible yeah. way. But, you know, there have been dietary patterns consistent with great longevity and really good health that have incorporated grains. They're typically minimally processed. And like Mediterranean diet has all sorts of, in Asia, there are rice. Parts of Asia with very interesting kinds of, well, brown rice is a whole kernel without gluten. But, you know, there's quinoa, which technically isn't a grain, but it kind of, we treat it like it. It's relatively higher in protein. It's gluten-free. Buckwheat is gluten-free. Teff, mm-hmm. Amaranth. There are all sorts of wonderful, very much more nutritious grains than we know. And so we are trying to broaden the possibility, but there are both gluten-free and grain-free options for people throughout the program.
Awesome.
And then in phase three, that's where you can begin to add back a little bit of processed carbohydrate. We just published a study in obesity that the journal Obesity that looked at what happens to metabolism after a month on a low carbohydrate diet. And we find that it seems to reset the beta cells so that the beta cells on a high carbohydrate diet have a hair trigger.
These are
they're ready to fire.
These are the insulin secreting cells in the pancreas, just for people who might not know.
Beta cells, yeah. The pancreas, they've got a hair trigger to release insulin. After a month on a low carbohydrate diet, they seem to calm down, and they calm down in a way that lasts even after adding back carbohydrate. So they wind up secreting less in response to the same amount of carbohydrate.
Wow.
Caused the big response earlier. So some people may be able to then trickle in a little bit, you know, a few treats and sweets. I mean, you know, if your body can handle it, why not have a pastry when you're traveling in Paris, or, you know, a little white pasta when you're traveling in Italy, or, you know, ice cream on a special occasion. There are some people for whom their biology is that if they start eating those things, it's going to start triggering cravings and a vicious cycle of weight gain. But by that point, they've discovered that feeling good, having control over hunger, is so much better than the fleeting pleasure of those processed carbohydrates that it's not easy to, it's not hard to just let it go.
It's a priceless feeling. Like when you're like, wow, I have resilience today. I can do what I want. My brain will obey me. My energy isn't crashing, and someone offers you a cookie, you're like, I don't care what's in that cookie. And at least the process I went through as I was losing the 100 pounds and keeping it off was, it used to be like, I'll just do like a cheat day Friday night. I'll just have like a loaf of bread, the crunchy French bread, which is relatively high glycemic, even though it was whole grain. And then the next day I'd be okay. The day after, it was like horrible cravings. And after a while, I'm like, you know what? It's just not worth it, because my energy bounces around for several days after I do that. But now, this is, you know, years later, grain still does, like gluten specifically still causes cravings, but I can tolerate sugar. Like my metabolism is fixed. Yeah. I can go to a kid's birthday and have a gluten-free slice of a birthday cake. It's probably not the optimal food for stable energy and feeling great and having less inflammation. I might see a little muffin top from some ingredient,
yeah.
whatever. But I can tolerate it without turning into a monster and like just,
You know, that's important that we, you know, if we're talking to not just, you know, foodies like us, you know, and the 1% of the population that, you know, biohacks, you know, we want there to be some flexibility, but the key is flexibility according to your individual ability to handle it, which is
right.
not going to be the same as somebody else. It's going to vary with age. It's going to vary with your physical activity level, with your genes, with what you've been doing for the last 20 years. And so we, in the phase three of our program, we give people symptom trackers.
Lovely.
That you plot out, and you can then see, all right, I was able to, I was doing fine when I added this, and I was doing fine when I, oh, here, that's where I started, interesting, like I'm now seeing the craving, I'm seeing this and that. And so then you just dial it a little bit back, and that's not set in stone. Maybe a year later, you'll readjust it, but you know for right then, that's the right prescription for you.
So we have a lot of commonalities in our thinking about food, and one of the things that's free that we use, and I want to get your honest opinion about it, is it's an app called Food Detective that I put out there. And you track in it, you type in what you ate, but it looks at changes in your heart rate after you eat for the next 90 minutes. And if you eat something that you're sensitive to, which is going to cause an adrenal response, which is going to cause cravings via the pathway you just described at the beginning of our conversation, that if you can have this predictable rise in heart rate, and you can see which foods do it because you kept a little journal and then you got your heart rate, that maybe you should not eat those foods that are triggering the adrenal response. In other words, allow your body to avoid those for a while so you can calm that down. Is there merit to that approach in the things you understand or in conjunction with the symptom tracker that you're working with, or is that kind of different?
You know, it's an interesting theory. I'm a scientist, so you know, when I hear an interesting idea, my first thought is, you know, it would be a good thing to test. You know, you may have data on it, and or you know, that might be something that we could look at.
I can send you some of the research. It's based on it's some relatively old research. Like you had some of the older stuff when they didn't have some of the very like focused looks where you sort of exclude all these variables, where they were looking at systemic behavioral things. This was one of the first ways to detect food allergies before we had blood panels to do that. So yeah. I'll send you some notes afterwards on that, because I think there's, what's the guy's name, Broca test, I want to call it, but I could have his name wrong off the top of my head. But it's an interesting thing, and it's something that helped me dial in, okay, you know, if I'm having a problem with that food, I'll be able to see it. And it's like, why am I kind of feeling a little faster? But then you measure it and you go, oh, wait, there is something going on. But it's just not an obvious thing. In your case, you've got a symptom tracker. Is it an online thing or is it a thing in the book?
In the book, we're going to, it's available. It'll be available online for people to download. Okay. So you can do it electronically. And, you know, maybe, you know, if somebody wants to do this with us, we could make an app, you know, make a symptom tracker app. It's based on 5 symptoms, and you want to look at how those 5 symptoms change in coordination with what you're eating.
Yeah.
And then you also look at what's happening to your weight. You know, so it's okay. Hunger, cravings, energy level, general sense of well-being, you know, duration of satiety, and you put that all together and come up with a kind of an integrated picture of how what you're eating is actually affecting you.
It might be interesting to connect you up with Jonathan Baylor, who may even have an app like that. He's working with this SANE thing around satiety of foods. He's been a guest on the show, so I can make an email introduction afterwards. Mm-hmm. And there's something to be said here around looking at data. When I first started noticing the changes in my energy, I started out like not looking at my fat. I'd failed at the fat thing, but I was looking at my brain because I was having such energy crashes and taking smart drugs and just trying to prop up my energy. And I started taking notes. I had a work notebook. And when you work in Silicon Valley, we all use these engineering notebooks because then if there's ever a lawsuit, you can see if someone tore out a page. And that way you've kind of protected your intellectual property. So in the margins on these books, I would like energy crash, 2:00. What did I have for lunch? And I'd write it down. And I did this for a long time until I just built this awareness of, wait, I'm causing these. They're not random. And they're not just, oh, I should pay more attention to this meeting. It's like, I can't pay more attention to this meeting because my brain won't do it. And it wasn't a personal failing. It was an energy failing. And when I finally just got that through my head and figured out, oh yeah, if I eat this cookie 3 hours later or 2 days later, whatever the time was, the zombie mode's going to happen. That was really important. And here it is. You've got it in a book. And that's why I'm such a big supporter about this. And I'm just so pleased. I can't wait till this comes out in January. Now, I had a couple other questions for you here. One of them is around a metric that I learned about when I was trying to figure out why I didn't gain weight when I cranked up the butter in my Bulletproof coffee. I ended up spending a time where I was doing between 4,000 and 4,500 calories a day. And my plan was, to do overfeeding, but to overfeed and to maybe gain 3 pounds when the math said I should gain 20 pounds. Like, well, wait, why is there such a big disparity? And I was eating very, very low carbohydrates. I was eating, you know, tons of bulletproof coffee and tons of steak and tons of vegetables, but not starchy vegetables. And I ended up losing weight on that number of calories. And I was like, okay, what's going on? So as I'm digging in on all this, I found a metric from the agriculture industry, like the feedlot industry. And they have a metric called feed efficiency. And they found that by administering antibiotics, they had a 30% change in feed efficiency. That means on exactly the same number of calories, the cows got 30% fatter when they had tiny amounts of these drugs. Doesn't that, the existence of that, kind of violate this physics of calories in, calories out?
You know, I think we really agree, of course, that the calorie balance model works well if you're a toaster oven.
That's a great tweet, you know, right,
but
there.
But, you know, but humans aren't machines.
Yeah.
And so what happens is that we adapt to changes in calories. When calories go down, our metabolism slows. And when they go up, our metabolism speeds up, you know, over time. And so we adapt to it. And as a consequence, and that we're not even getting into perhaps an even more interesting question is what happens to body composition. You know, we did a study with rodents. I don't like to do a lot of animal studies, but it's hard to control people's lifestyles totally. You can't just lock them up for 6 months.
And prisoner diet studies are looked down upon in the West.
That's not cool.
Although, frankly, you might be doing better than what they're feeding them anyway. So, that's a whole other discussion, right?
Another discussion. And so we gave these rodents the same proteins, fat, and carbohydrate, just again, one fast-acting carbs, the other slow-acting carbs. In both cases, starches, just fast-digesting starch or slow-digesting starch. And we found that the animals eating the fast-digesting starch, they started gaining weight excessively. So what we did was we did what you're supposed to according to the calorie balance model, which is cut back calories. And we did that, and we kept the weight gain of the two groups the same. But the fast-acting carb group, so gained the same amount of weight with fewer calories, which means that its metabolism was slowing down. Then at the end of the study, we analyzed body composition. We used something called tritiated water. It's an isotope. Okay. And that goes through aqueous water, but not fat. And we found that at the same weight, the animals that had the fast-acting carb had 70% more fat.
Oh, wow.
So if they're the same weight and you have that much more fat, guess what you have less of?
I have less lean muscle, right?
Specifically muscle. So this gets at what has been called tofi. Thin outside, fat inside.
Oh, the skinny fat thing, right?
That's right. Even if you have a normal BMI, you may be at major risk for weight-related complications because of your body composition and your metabolism. And so this is another way. When we eat calories, do those calories wind up going to muscle and being oxidized? They get oxidized or burned because you're going to be feeling energetic. And you'll be, even if you don't work out and get on a Stairmaster, you're going to be fidgeting. You're going to be wanting to burn off those calories. Or are those calories being directed to fat cells, and are they serving only to cause more obesity, you know, more fat development?
Okay.
So that's a really key thing. None of this is explained by the calorie balance model. It has to do with the metabolic effects of calories. And, you know, the chief culprit here, I think, is the refined carbohydrates. But beyond that, we want to get the balance of protein, fat, and carbohydrate right. And then we want to bring in some lifestyle supports, because other things besides diet affects fat cells. Stress, sleep deprivation, and being too sedentary. And I don't mean like not getting on a Stairmaster. I just mean spending too much time sitting. So we want to get people to engage in enjoyable physical activities, not to burn off calories, but to tone their metabolism.
Very, very well said. I don't see you at a standing desk, though.
I'm fidgeting.
Okay. I use a stand desk, one of those electric ones that goes up and down. I've been helping the company get going. And it's funny, I sit down for Bulletproof Radio and because we just built a studio, but I'm thinking about changing it to be a standing studio because sometimes I'll record two of these in a row and like I don't want to sit all day because I'm fidgeting too because it's important. You know, you cross your legs different ways and you move your body differently because if you sit still all the time, it's just bad. Like and it does contribute to weight gain in a way that's independent of exercise, right? What do you think of standing desks or using treadmill desks and things like that? Like, how important is that in the overall scheme of things?
You know, a study just came out. I'm new to social media, but I'm not sure if I Facebooked it or tweeted it. I did one of those two. It was in the New York Times just very recently. And what they did was look at people who were given standing desks, you know, just as you mentioned. And not unexpectedly, their energy expenditure, their calorie burn went up when they were using, their calorie burn went up when they were using the standing desk. But guess what happened later?
They ate more because...
expenditure. Well, I don't think they looked
okay.
But they looked at their energy expenditure and it plummeted later in the day. So if you're standing more during the daytime, you're going to be sitting or lying more later. Now, why would that be? Well, it may be just the same as calorie is eating, that if you cut back calories now, you're probably going to overeat later, unless you alter the basic fundamental equation. And there are other studies, and I actually have a section in the book that reviews this, why exercise doesn't cause weight loss. You know, exercise is good for a lot of reasons, but short of marathon level, weight loss just isn't one of the benefits. And that's because, you know, when you work out, you burn off more calories, but then you tend to compensate. So our activity level, like our appetite, may be regulated by parts of our brain. And so the only way around that is to shift the set point. And the set point is shifted not by just burning off calories and sticking to the same diet. You have to alter what you eat and these other lifestyle influences on fat cells.
That makes great sense. And it gives me great pleasure that here you are with a lifetime of research in this, working with, you know, Boston Children's Hospital and working with Harvard and saying things like exercise isn't a great way to lose weight. And I grew up thinking, well, geez, if I just can exercise an hour and a half a day, 6 days a week, I'll finally lose this weight. And it never worked. And it made me so mad. And if I go on a low-fat diet, it's going to work. And you could lose 20 pounds and gain 30 and lose 30 and gain 40 and all that. And so thanks for doing the research and putting this out there.
Yeah, thank you. And, you know, it's also, you just think of the human toll that this calorie balance model has taken on us psychologically.
It's one of the most cruel and evil things you can do, especially if you apply it to kids.
Yeah, if all calories are alike, then it's your fault, you're fat, for not being able to control your calorie balance. And guess who gets carte blanche? The food industry.
Yep.
You know, because there are no bad foods. You know, they can market junk foods. It's fine to eat chips and cookies and crackers and sugary drinks. Just make sure to balance that and burn it off. Even if you could burn off the calories in a big Coke, very few of us, you know, actually can. But even if you could, you're still going to be in a worse off metabolic state.
Yeah. It's not sustainable and it's not a way to live. So getting this out there into our consciousness so that people stop being surprised when you say to the waitress, I'm sorry, two asparagus spears isn't going to cut it. That's not a side of vegetables. And no, I didn't want, you know, the quadruple helping of macaroni and cheese that you put on there. just making these shifts so that we're having quality food in the right amounts. When it becomes the norm, we're going to look like people looked in the 1970s. Like I love looking at TV shows from the 70s because everyone, their bodies are shaped differently. And even the people who aren't...
Especially children.
Oh, yeah. Like they're not in shape the way like a super ripped, like lean, muscular, kind of steroid, dehydrated
kids,
guy.
Kids look like rails back then.
Yeah.
I mean, they really, most kids were just really thin.
Yeah.
And, the heavy kid was the relatively rare exception, unfortunately, would oftentimes get, bullied and picked on back then, just as today.
Yeah. As that heavy kid, I can tell you, the heavy kid will sit on you if you bully them, so don't do that. But anyway. what were you saying?
But I think, the basic point is, we have to reverse the psychological toll taken on people from the calorie balance model. It's not your fault, you're fat. That's not a message that you'll ever hear from the food industry, because they want to blame the problem on you and not the massive infusion of industrial processed foods into the American diet. But, if you're eating these foods, you're going to be programmed biologically to gain weight. And it's, even you may be following conventional nutritional recommendations, which were wrong.
They were.
And it's not your fault that those recommendations were wrong. And it's not your fault that you can't stay on a diet, on a calorie-restricted diet, because it's really more about biology than willpower. And I think that this is ultimately a psychologically liberating message, that it's just like any other medical condition. We wouldn't blame someone for a fever and just say, wait a second, you've got, it's just a question of heat in and heat out. Get into an ice bath if you've got a fever, and your body temperature will go down. Well, it will. But guess what? How many people can do that when they have a fever? You're going to be severely shivering. Your blood vessels will be constricting. You'll feel miserable.
Yeah.
You give somebody an aspirin and the fever comes down naturally. Give someone the right diet and a few other supports, body weight comes down naturally.
It's a great message. And the food industry, it needs disrupting because it's broken. And that's one of the things I'm here to do. I architected the Bulletproof Bar, these protein bars, the collagen protein and tons of brain octane. I got tired of eating things that made me hungry. So I engineered something that is designed to not make me feel hungry. And I'm looking at putting a money back guarantee on them right now and saying, all right, eat this. And if you're still hungry 2 hours later, either you just ran a marathon or there's something else going on, because it doesn't happen. And that's the exact opposite of what a food company does if they want to make money. Because a food company, 100 calorie high glycemic bar, you eat that, you'll eat another one an hour later and another one an hour later. And each time it's cha-ching, cha-ching. But if you make a bar that feeds someone for a long period of time, then you sell a lot less. And I think that changes the whole economics of the food industry if you sell food that makes you full versus food that makes you hungry. And there's a dawning awareness of people who are learning what you've just taught in your book, which is that, okay, if I experience that craving feeling, the one we talked about before, I did something, and they're going to look back in your application or in the journal that you give them, they're going to say, oh, look, I ate the processed food, I had the craving, and they're going to put two and two together, and then the processed food that used to be valuable because it's addictive becomes valueless, and people will refuse to eat it. And then it's no longer a good economic model. So when people get the awareness that you're teaching, it will disrupt the food industry. Absolutely will do it. And people will choose foods that they don't need as much of and foods that leave them really satisfied. And that will change the entire ecosystem, because we'll grow different foods in order to feed people that way. So that's what's coming. And the big food companies, they don't have a choice about it. It's not theirs anymore.
The epilogue of my book, the book is really based on trying to deliver the science in the first part and then a program for people to follow. But the epilogue of the book takes on the political and policy issue.
Yes.
It considers our diet and our health as matters of national security. If we don't do something about diet and obesity-related diseases, we're looking at massively increasing budget deficits, which I argue is contributing to the political polarization in Washington. Democrats and Republicans are fighting because there's less and less discretionary spending, all those resources are being siphoned off into diet-related disease, and that we really have to become all advocates and activists, voting with the ballot and also voting with the fork.
It's amazing what happens when you start paying attention to what those things are doing to you. I tend to think there's so much fighting in Congress because they're all eating processed foods, but maybe maybe it's more complex than that.
Maybe it's the people who vote them into office are eating all the processed
foods. There you go.
And if we get off, you know, if we raise our consciousness, you know, what's the old saying? People lead, the leaders will follow. Mm-hmm. You know, eating well is a radical political act.
It is indeed.
We transform our health. We become role models. We influence the food supply. And if enough of us are doing it and starting to demand, like, why aren't we hearing, you know, in the political debates, why aren't we hearing at least one question about food policy?
I guess I'm just going to have to choose my plate, so to speak. And it's just, it's not okay to see the disconnect between what's recommended and what works. And so thanks for taking your huge body of work and just the amount of academic research and credentials that you have, and then writing a book that says incredibly radical things like exercise isn't the best way to lose weight. And that one statement, which is that overeating doesn't make you fat, but getting fat makes you overeat. That is seriously radical stuff, and it's awesome. Now,
thank you.
You're very welcome. And there's one more question that I want to ask you. And this is a question I've asked every guest on the show.
And am I in trouble?
You're not in trouble at all. It's given all the stuff you've learned, if someone came to you tomorrow and said, look, not just from a nutritional perspective, but from a life perspective, I want to perform better at everything I do, right? So I want to be able to sleep better. I want to be a better mom. I want to be a better CEO, whatever it is they want to do. But I want to kick more ass at life. What are the top three recommendations that you would offer for that person?
Well, you know, as much as my day job and my life revolves around food, we'll maybe make that, you know, number one. But we also have to realize that the best diet in the world can't fill emotional emptiness. So, you know, we need to be eating number one, a whole foods diet that is deeply satisfying to us, nourishing to us, and are going to help our body lose weight, find its natural weight, whatever that happens to be, and can get us out of this endless cycle of fad popular diets and all the suffering that's created. We need, I think, number two, we all really need to manage stress. You know, we're just living, and I, you know, guilty as charged. You know, we're all driving very hard. We're putting our bodies into this anabolic state. You know, our fat cells are in an anabolic state from too much insulin. You know, that means it's being forced, you know, to store. But that stress is also affecting our fat cells, our brain. So we need to be reducing stress and sleeping better. And I know that's a central part of your work. And then, you know, the third part is love and connection and community. You know, mm-hmm. We can be really healthy and de-stressed, but life gets pretty lonely at the top of a mountain if, you know, you're not an enlightened master. So, you know, we need to be building supportive relationships, and those relationships not only nourish us, but become the network for social change that feeds back and makes our environment even better so that we can eat even better and feel less stress.
I love it. Thank you for sharing. Where can people find out more about your work?
The first place is to have a look at our book, Always Hungry, with the question mark at the end, which comes out January 5th.
That'll be on Amazon. Can they pre-order it today?
You can pre-order it right away, and we have a promotion that provides some extra web specials in advance if you pre-order through the website. The website is drdavidludwig, davidludwig.com. Also, it can be found on Facebook, David Ludwig, MD.
Okay.
And Twitter as well, David Ludwig, MD.
Okay.
And another way to reach us is alwayshungrybook.com.
All right. That sounds like that's probably the best place to send people. So to find out more about the book, our conversation is alwayshungrybook.com. And you're going to have your offers for the book there as well. So you give people a bunch of free web content. So here's a suggestion that I would have for people listening. Given that December 1st, the Bulletproof, the cookbook comes out. This is something, 125 recipes, which I can guarantee you will be in alignment with the things that are in your book. So when you pick up your coffee, when you pick up your copy, not your coffee, of the Bulletproof cookbook, why don't you also, in exactly the same time, in the same shopping cart, pick up a copy of Always Hungry? Because when you do that, that'll associate those two on Amazon, and that way people who are into Bulletproof can understand that Always Hungry has some really cool info about physiology and psychology in there, and other people who shop for either of the books can find both of them together, because these are books that belong together, because they have some really similar philosophies, and they're both about this idea of, look, you shouldn't have cravings all the time, and there's things you can do. So add the cookbook in there, because the cookbook's going to help you do the things that are in Always Hungry, which are going to help you feel better. And you've got your own set of good recipes in there, and you'll give away some other free stuff on your website, alwayshungry.com.
And you can never have too many great recipes.
Exactly. And I'll make sure to send you a copy of the cookbook as well as soon as we get one. Awesome. David, thanks so much for being on Bulletproof Radio. Thanks for your work, and thanks for stepping out on a limb and saying these radical statements like food quality matters more than calories and exercise isn't the best way to lose weight. I very much resonate with what you're saying. My own life has shown me that your research is accurate and that it's actionable and it's useful and it's actually something people can implement. So thanks for going out there and thanks for doing it. Have an awesome day.
Well, thanks for having me, and congratulations on, you know, your own transformation and your dedication to the health of others as well.
Thanks.
Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.